occasion. I wouldn't be able to do what I've done over the years had it not been for Carol. And Carol has worked in the arts for years and years and years. Well, she is now, she's an iconographer, which is basically the painting of religious icons within the Orthodox tradition. There is a school of iconography called the Proserpon School, that various schools in iconography. And she has her first exhibition, or part of an exhibition, in fact, next month. So she's dedicated herself to it. And it's interesting that she comes from quite a Protestant evangelical background. So for her to go into iconography and to within the disciplines of the Orthodox Church is a huge journey, yes. Very much so. So that's that, to answer your question. Yes, born and brought up in Liverpool, born in December 1952. So I am very much a child of the Macmillan era, really, in many ways. And never had it so good. We just never had it. And but there was an element whereby I was grateful for my upbringing. Looking back at it now, I mentioned Willie Russell before, and we were between the classes that we were giving people on this songwriter's course. We were comparing notes, and we belong to a generation of Liverpool-born artists who were in many ways so fortunate, because there was a window in Liverpool, I would say, a generational window, a sociological window, from about 54, 55, end of rationing, through to the end of the 60s. And that was my formative period. And there was an element of full employment. Then the docks collapsed and containerization came in, and Liverpool went into a very fast decline. I left Liverpool in 73, so I didn't live through that awful decline, but I knew people that did, and obviously my mother stayed in the city during that period. And come the 1980s, it was bad. It was awful, really. Liverpool has regenerated itself, and I don't need to underline the fact that there have been certain things in Liverpool's recent past, not least Hillsborough, before that the Toxteth riots, that brought Liverpool to a point of reassessment of itself as a city, really. And it's now in a position perhaps of thinking better about itself.
Just taking you back a bit, Stuart, what was it actually like as a kid growing up in Liverpool for you?
It was very odd. I remember there was a lollipop lady called Molly Sale, and she seemed to sort of encapsulate...
Sorry, a lollipop lady, Molly the
Molly the Lolly, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And it was very much so. But she was the mother of a comedian called Alexis Sale. Some of you may be feel so-called godfather of alternative comedy. If you think Alexis is fierce, you should have met Molly. Oh my goodness. Marxist lollipop lady, as opposed to a Maoist Leninist lollipop lady, because the political divisions are very important. And Molly was the first woman I ever heard swear. And she was absolutely extraordinary in many ways. And so she is a memory of childhood, of swearing at the traffic and helping the children over the road. She'd be swearing at sort of capitalist bread lorries that were on their way to Kirby to deliver some cakes. So she remains a memory. And then I remember I was brought up in Anfield, and I was at the window one day looking out. It was early winter, and I was standing with my mother, And then all of a sudden we hear this terrible commotion outside, and it was two women fighting, two of our neighbours, Nellie and Joan, and they were going at it. This wasn't Handbags at Dawn. This really was Sonny Liston and Cassius Clay, as he was. They were really hammering one another. And I watched my mother assess the situation, and then she went out into the street and she separated them. And because it was her, because it was my mother had that meek authority, they stopped. And I paraphrased what my mother said. She said, "Ladies, what are you doing? How shameful." So she gave them a sort of 30-second moral sermon to say, this is not how we behave. Yeah. This is not good. So my mother became a peacemaker. That stayed with me, very much so, as to... I've been in various conflicts, both business, personal and private conflicts over the years. And my mother remained a sort of a benchmark. Yeah. She was a very quiet Christian. She just went about her business, living peace, really.
It sounds quite a contrast. You gave us the poem about your grandmother. Yeah, it sounds a very different...
Oh, our house was a house of enormous contrasts, because my uncle, my great uncle, who this is where whenever anybody starts talking about the auntie of the uncle of the father, I get very confused, so bear with me. My great-uncle was married to the sister of my grandmother. My great-uncle was a member of the Communist Party. He was an early Welsh nationalist, and also he'd fought in the Spanish Civil War. Wow. And he was a Welsh speaker. So when he came calling, you can imagine the tension between my grandmother and him, politically opposed to one another, and he would never talk to her. Wow. And he would only talk in Welsh to his wife, my grandmother's sister. He wouldn't speak in English. The only time he spoke in English was he spoke to me in English.
Goodness.
So there was this these odd dynamics going on.
Yeah.
The denial, the refusal to acknowledge one another. And again, that contributed to me saying, away with this.
Yeah.
Really.
Away with this, not away from Liverpool. You didn't.
Not away from Liverpool, but away with... I learned... very early on, I referred, to my grandmother, and she had a couple of friends, dear ladies, dear ladies, who used to come round, and they'd gather in the parlour once a week for anemic tea and rather sparse biscuits, nothing too fancy, no bourbons or custard creams, just basically plain cardboard, and... I was allowed to come in and say hello to the sisters and sit in the corner, and then they would rip into the Catholics.
Wow.
It was incredibly bitter. And then they'd put their hats on and they'd go back down the road and they'd go to church on the following Sunday. And I thought that this doesn't fit.
No.
This isn't working, really.
No.
The faith has to be authentic. The faith has to be embracing. The faith has to be wide and generous and rigorous.
Yeah.
But it can't be this.
No.
So I learned by example of how not to do it.
Yeah.
But then again, having said that, they were products of their generation.
Yes.
So I have to be generous. They were products of a highly sectarian city before the First World War, and especially between the wars as well. It was dwindling to a certain extent by the time I left school. But I do remember, I remember very clearly, every 12th of July when the Orange Lodge marched, they'd march past our school, and of course we were still in school, and opposite was a Catholic grammar school. And that was the only time there was trouble between my Protestant grammar school and the Catholic grammar school. And in that Catholic grammar school, St. Francis Xavier was Jimmy McGovern, the playwright.
Oh, yeah.
And he has very dark memories of his childhood.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, McGovern of late is coming back to his, sort of coming back with sympathy to his cradle Catholicism.
Because there's been a series on the TV, hasn't
yes.
there, with Sean Bean, I
with
think?
With Sean Bean, yes. I thought it was a remarkable series.
Yeah. Yeah.
A remarkable piece of acting, a remarkable piece of writing.
Yeah.
It was the social gospel at its best.
Yeah. Really. Let me pick up on something you've already mentioned, and also following on, people. It's just amazing the number of names that trip off the tongue. Jimmy McGovern, Willie
yeah.
Russell.
Yeah.
Cilla Black, dare I mention,
yeah.
but just the creative spirit of Liverpool in
yeah.
that era.
Yes.
What was that all about, Stuart?
Well, again, it was a certain time. It was a certain time when things came together, where the stars in alignment, things coalesced.
Yeah.
We were the generation, we were the family allowance generation, so our parents, it was the second child onwards, wasn't it, I think, I seem to remember. So there was the generosity of and the Attlee government was responsible for that.
Yeah.
And then when Churchill came back into power in 51 and successive Tory governments up until 64, they thought we need to carry this on if we need to stay in power.
Right.
But also there was an element of one nation Toryism. You probably are hearing me being incredibly BBC balanced, and I will continue to be. So far as politics are
yeah.
concerned, because that's important, because I am of the BBC generation that had instilled into us in the right way, you look at both
yeah.
sides and you assess.
Yeah.
And that's why I was taking a bit of a dig before with the poem Eyes Down, because I see within the social media generation such polarisation. People expressing opinions when they perhaps have no back knowledge
yeah.
of the whole story.
Yes.
So I go into in recent years I've become a visiting lecturer at one of the Birmingham universities, and I'm teaching in effect primary school teachers the rudiments of poetry, of teaching poetry in the classroom, and basically saying, if you don't understand the poem that you're reading out, the children won't understand it. But the thing that I hammer again and again and again is, if you're going to try and understand something totally, such as war poetry, you can take the pacifist line, but there have been wars in the past which have been necessary.
Yeah.
So you need 360 degree thinking.
Yeah.
You need wide thinking, and not just saying, well, this is a war poem, this is awful.
Yeah.
No, that's not respecting the poet who may well have died. There's a wonderful poet from the Second World War called Keith Douglas, and he was in a tank division, and he was killed. And one that I think is one of the great lines of war poetry, how easy it is to become a ghost. And that resonates with me. So I try to say to these young teachers, when you are teaching weighty matters to Key Stage 2 and Key Stage 3 kids, you have to be objective.
Yeah.
Don't put your own swing on it,
yeah.
especially in matters of faith, morality, and the ethics of war.
Yeah. Yeah. Stuart, you mentioned obviously your work for the BBC, which we're going to come back to if we may, and poetry. Have you always made a living as a poet, or how did you kind of start off when you left school? Did you kind of at school go to the careers and say, I'm going to be a poet, or how did it work?
Please say it, I want to be a poet. do you? Now, how it came about was, it's going back to your very personal observation before about the Liverpool generation of writers. And I was fortunate in as much as there were three poets, Roger McGough, Brian Patton, and the late Adrian Henry.
Yeah.
So I was around about the age of 16 when I was really immersing myself in poetry. And we were fortunate in as much as Roger, Brian, and Adrian had laid down a template of poetry readings
yeah.
all over Merseyside, starting at the Liverpool Everyman Theatre and moving
yeah.
Outward. And then there was a lady called Peggy Poole who organised a series of poetry readings on the Wirral over the water from Liverpool called Jabberwocky. And she had an incredibly eclectic approach One week, it would be a group of local poets reading. The next week, or the next month, sorry, their monthly readings, it could be Ted Hughes or Seamus Heaney.
Oh, wow.
And then the following month, it would be back to local poets. Yeah. You never knew what you were going to get. Yeah. And that was my training ground, really. So I started to do floor spots at these poetry readings, and how it would work was that there would be an invited poet in the second half, possibly a Hughes or a Heaney. I never actually read with either of them, but other poets of that stature, that ilk, and they would be the second half, and then there would be floor spots and poets, you put your name down. And Peggy Poole especially used to run a tight ship. She'd check the poems beforehand.
Right.
And if she thought they weren't, if they were still in the development stages, she'd say, no, not tonight, darling. Go away and work on it. And that was great training as well.
Yes.
That was really good. And that was a keen, rigorous eye on her part. So that's how it started. And then me and three other lads, we put together a little poetry pamphlet called Undergrowth, which we sold at gigs. Four of us with about 10 poems each. Wow. Then I did my first one. I put together a wee pamphlet, sold at gigs again. Mm. And then I thought I need some sort of strategy here. So I began to think about publishing or getting published by the leading publishing houses. Brian Patton had done it with George Allen and Unwin. Mm. And then Brian, Adrian and Roger were published by Penguin, Mersey Poets number, I think it was Penguin Poets number 10, and it was the Mersey Poets, and it sold hundreds of thousands. And so, to cut a very long story short, I ended up with Hodder and Stoughton for a couple of books, and that was my aim.
Yes.
And the books sold, and the books went into profits, because that's all a publisher wants to know. It's not about the colour of your eyes or your wild and interesting aesthetic. It's, will this book sell?
Yeah.
So I've always had one eye on, will these poems resonate with people?
Yes. And you said there's also something about a living has to be made.
Yeah.
So you get commissions?
I get commissions. Having reached sort of the grand old age of 65 now, I am aware I'm going through a sort of an Indian summer. How much longer I will last, who knows.
Yeah.
When Adrian died, that was a bit of a wake-up call to us all.
Yeah.
Because we thought we were immortal, and we're not. Well, we are, but we're not. yes. We're not mortally immortal. Yeah. And so I'm thinking now, right, what is it I want to do in the remaining years?
Yeah.
And going back to your question about commissions, I'm starting to turn down some commissions. Okay. But how it usually works is either a publisher or an editor, especially for anthologies, will approach me, and it will be one of the big ones. It'll either be Macmillan or OUP, Oxford University Press, or Blackie's, or JK's publisher, Bloomsbury.
Bloomsbury. Yeah.
And they will say, okay, we've got an anthology coming off, and it is about A, B, or C, and we'd like two or three poems from you.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been doing over the past 10 years, and then writing regularly for radio and television, poetry slots, alongside making radio programs as well. I think I may have said before to somebody today that Radio 4 is a brilliant, it's a brilliant day centre for poets, really. It is. It's a rest home for poets. because people like myself, Michael Rosen, Ian Macmillan, Barnsley Bard, and Roger McGough make programmes, Roger, Michael and Ian, on Radio 3 with The Verb. Yeah. They all have their own series. I had my own series for 10 years.
Yeah.
So it's radio and poetry are a perfect fit.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. You did at the very beginning of your bit this evening, Stuart, you anticipated that for a lot of people, poetry doesn't immediately, you know, doesn't connect, if you like.
Yes.
And people, a lot of people get put off
poetry.
Why do you think that is, and what's that about?
Well, I think it's a generational thing. Hopefully, I've become an intergenerational poet. You know, this morning, we were with a bunch of 8-9-year-olds, and it's learning to speak the language. Poetry is learning to speak the language to the group that you're hoping to communicate to, and that's what it's about. Yeah. And because, going back again to the Liverpool apprenticeship, it wasn't written down, but we had an approach. We didn't have access to the London publishing houses. We were just a bunch of blokes, and it was mainly blokes back then. Thankfully, there have been some fine women poets come along in the past few years. Interestingly, Caroline Duffy, the present poet laureate, was at Liverpool University during the 70s, and she picked up the Liverpool pixie, really. Yeah. And she has that approach to her poetry. And so, going back to your question, what I try to do is to relive and carry on and almost evangelize the Liverpool approach of the 60s and 70s was that poetry and the arts are for everyone.
Yeah.
If it's exclusive, then I would question its validity, really. Yeah. The object of the exercise is for people to go away feeling better about themselves after hearing one of my poems, or if it's one of the more solemn poems, then that I've identified with the listeners, and the subject matter resonates. When Jesus stood up and communicated, it was interesting to look at him as a model of how to communicate to various groups. Mm. To the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the religious, he spoke a different language.
Yeah.
To the ordinary people, he spoke a different language. He used different metaphors, he used different similes, he used jokes. Now, admittedly, the jokes actually don't translate well because they've been through three translations. They've been through Aramaic to Greek into 17th century English, into modern English, and so you lose the joke along the way. But his speech was relevant to each group he was talking to, and I think a brilliant model of communication. He assessed the audience. What do I say in this situation?
Yeah.
How do I critique this group in this situation? Mm-hmm. Eyes down is a critique. Yeah. It is a critique of social media and what we've lost in our ability not to communicate anymore. Yeah. And I think of the North as perhaps in a rather romantic way as a place that's resisted because Northerners are generally warmer. I'm caricaturing, but they are generally warmer. But again, I was quite shocked when I got the train yesterday from Sheffield out to Chapeltown, and it was a commuter train, and everybody was... Now, admittedly, the view isn't too brilliant as you pass Meadowhall.
That's fair.
But again, at the same time, it's what social media has done to us. It's diminished us.
Yeah.
It's hunched us. Yeah. It means that we've lost our ability to communicate or even to empathise,
Just picking up on a slightly different angle on that, Stuart, your poem about Eyes Down, where does a poem begin for you? Presumably not with Eyes Down.
Yes, that is a toughie. A poem usually ambushes you. I think I used that phrase today in one of the schools. A poem does ambush you. And also the poets that I know, it's as if they have a satellite dish, on an invisible satellite dish on top of their heads. They're picking up signals all the time. Yeah. It may be how somebody says something, or I think I am very attuned to what is being said behind the words. The Irish playwright Beckett said that language is a veil. We say things, but there is a meaning behind the saying, which may be different to what we're saying. It's as if it's the whole. The British are very good at deliberate insincerity. That is a really interesting hat. No, it really. Are you going to wear it again? you know, that sort of thing.
Yes.
The English are actually quite adept at that. So it's hearing the truth behind what may not be the truth.
Yes.
And I remember towards the end of his life, I had quite a long conversation with the playwright Harold Pinter. Mm. And Pinter's language was brilliant at taking cliché, and the British are brilliant at clichés, taking the cliché and giving it a deeper meaning. And also he used silences in an extraordinary way. Because silence is speech as well. Just because somebody's not saying anything doesn't mean they're not talking. And you get that through Pinter's work. And talking to him at the end of his life, and he was dying, and he wasn't well at all, and we were discussing mortality. And the only reason I got to talk to Pinter was through an actor friend of ours, a guy called Peter Vaughan, who died recently. For those of you who remember Porridge, Peter Vaughan played Harry Grout. And then for younger generation, Peter Vaughan played the blind sage on the North Wall in Game of Thrones, Maester Aemon.
Right.
Peter had an extraordinary career. So it was through Peter I could go up to Harold Pinter, who was a formidable man, and say, "You don't know me, but..." And I knew Harold was a great admirer of Peter. Anyway, this is getting quite convoluted. Talking to Pinter... and we had two metaphors, really, for mortality. One of which is, he said to me, "I don't know what's beyond. I don't think anything is there." Mm. And I said, "How can you be sure if you haven't been there?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "I could give you an opinion about China, but I've never been. I've no idea. I've read about it, but I've no idea."
Yeah.
And so I was slightly taking him on because he liked to rise to he liked an intellectual joust, really. Yeah. And then the other metaphor he used was cricket. That basically life is like cricket. He was a great cricket player. That life is like the cricket match, and that there is a and he then likened a cricket match to a play, in as much there is a structure. And there is a conclusion. It will come to a conclusion. Right. It may be a really drab draw, or it may be an exciting finish where somebody knocks a six out of the ground, so that life can dwindle to an end, or life can reach a celebratory note at the end.
Yeah.
And I thought that was actually quite interesting coming from somebody who professed atheism.
Yes.
Really.
And not known for his most cheery outlook on life.
Yes, yes, yeah, precisely, yes, yeah, very much.
Yes, yes. Stu, let me ask a bit about your broadcasting career. You've obviously worked quite a bit now for Radio 4.
Yeah.
You had your own show, Questions, Questions. Yeah. You do Pick of the Week fairly regularly.
Yes.
What are the things you've been if you had to think of one thing you've been most proud of that you've done for Radio 4, any particular thing comes to mind?
We could be here all night, but
just one.
We were talking about it before. It was a program called Something Understood, and there was a woman called Julie Nicholson, who was an Anglican priest, and those of us who remember the London Tube and bus bombings of 2005, okay. Julie Nicholson lost her daughter, Jennifer. Jennifer was on one of the tubes that went up, that was bombed. And Jennifer was a member, she was in her early 20s, she was just about to get married. The whole of the great banquet of life was before her. She had a good job, she was in London, she had a great circle of friends, and then this arbitrary act of wickedness took her. And Julie Nicholson, I think, with great integrity and great authenticity, stepped down from administering the sacraments as a priest because she said she could not feel anything but hate towards the people who had murdered her daughter. And so she did. Fast forward about 5 years, and I did a Something Understood with her, and we went back to the graveyard of where Jennifer was buried. At that stage, it didn't have a monument. She since has put up a monument. But there was something wonderful about the interview, in as much as I thought, what am I allowed morally that I feel comfortable with to ask her? Yeah. Because this is an intrusion, really. The media is an intrusion. The media thinks it's important. It's not. It's just, it's there to report as such. Ordinary lives go on. But because Julie knew of my poetry, she agreed to do the program.
Yeah.
And so we got to the end, we were getting towards the end of the interview within the church, and then we moved out to the graveyard. And it was the time that I almost lost it as an interviewer, because her voice softened, and she said, even though all that I've been through, and I've walked away from my vocational pastoral role as a priest, I am glad that I was ordained a priest, because I could go in and I had to identify what was left of my daughter's body, and there was just her fingertips just above the cloth, and she anointed her daughter with holy oil. And she said, in that moment, I was one with God, even though I did not understand his ways. And that's why I became a priest, just for that moment. And at which point I almost went, and again, old school BBC, you don't show your emotions. Yeah. You show empathy and sympathy, but you don't show your emotion. But in that moment, it was, this woman has unpeeled herself,
yes.
Really.
Yeah.
And the letters we got after that program were extraordinary.
Yeah.
People telling their stories of grief. So, to answer your question, it would be that programme.
Yes, yeah. Brilliant. Stuart, I want to, in a minute, give folks a bit of a chance to ask you a few questions. Just like to come to something we've sort of hinted at a little bit, which is your own Christian belief.
Yeah.
Did you kind of grow up with that, or what's your story of how you came to faith?
No, I went to just after my father died, when I was about 14, 15, I had a mate called Bill Mason, who went to the same school as me, and he was going to a Baptist church in the Everton district of Liverpool, and his mother said to him, you need to look after Stuart, because I was rather sort of mute, really, following the death of my father.
Yeah.
And so what happened then was I was invited to a party. And there were girls, I was so shy and embarrassed around girls. It was actually quite funny, because it was little glasses of cider and a bit of dancing, on all that caper. These are 15, 16-year-olds. Oh, it's all so innocent and glorious looking back then. But I was so shy, I plonked myself in the corner, and there was a pile of horror mags. Remember the old Hammer horror films?
Yeah.
Dracula and Frankenstein. These belong to Bill's older brother, Peter. And I just sat there reading them, and I'm terrified of horror magazines. I'm just reading them. I hope nobody talks to me, and so on. So that was the beginning of me coming out. And then Bill invited me to the church, the Baptist church in Evan. And the late David Shepherd, a former Anglican bishop of Liverpool, who I knew fairly well later on, David talked about pilgrims going through various conversions during the course of their life. There's the conversion to Christ, there is the conversion to the poor, there is the conversion to the cause of women and equality, and so on, and several other conversions. And he made the point there is the conversion especially to of remaining equitable politically, not showing your flank too much. And that's the best way I can sum it up, really.
Yeah.
Christ remains the central character. Christ remains the, for me, the saviour, the mother hen, the counsellor, the confidant, the anarchist, the comic. You don't hear too much about Christ the comic. Jesus is very funny, very subtle, really. I know that there is almost a caricature, there is some credence in it, that the media hates Christianity, and especially the BBC. Well, the BBC is not there to promote Christianity. The BBC is there as a public service broadcasting corporation, and it has to fulfill quite a complicated remit, really. I've never found, really, any antipathy towards me. If things of the Christian faith come up and I'm asked my opinion, I will give it. But I'm aware that we are living in this, wants a better description, multi-faith society, and the British have been not too good in giving people an equal voice. There's a verse, I think it's in Proverbs in the Old Testament, which basically says a person's gift makes room for them. You assess what somebody is saying, not so much on what they're saying, but are they consistent in their lifestyle? And that to me is important. And as I get older, it's a case of live it more and say it less.
I wanted to ask about that, because I guess some would say, you've got a fantastic opportunity, you know, pick of the week last week. Couldn't you just slot in a little bit of Christian message? Or how does your Christian faith inform the way you write and broadcast?
Well, for example, the last one, the last pick of the week, I was rather handed it on a plate, and I was quite fortunate in as much as, because when I do pick of the week, I'm responsible for all the picks. Sometimes I will have missed something, and the producer, I have a great relationship with the various producers in Salford, because I've been working with them for quite a while. And they will suggest, well, what do you think about this? And I think, oh, great. But generally it's 85% my picks. And the theme that was emerging was about the outsider. Well, Jesus said an awful lot about the outsider. When Jesus spoke to the Samaritan woman at the well, that was an extraordinary moment of theatre. She was very much an outsider. he turns her life around and she becomes an evangelist, in effect. Do you know what this man said to me? Do you know what this man knew about me? And I hadn't told him. So with the outsider theme for the last pick of the week, I just stressed through the clips about honouring and treasuring the outsider. Really. So to go back to your question, and people have said to me about that, and I've quoted back to them the BBC Charter, and also that perhaps it's a misplaced expectation to expect somebody in my position. I'm in a very humble, meager position, really. There are people who are in a far more prominent position. They are there to do a job. It's a bit like saying to a barrister or a doctor, are you only going to sort of deal with cases about, you know, with Christians, you know, and help them and so on and so forth? We are there to spread salt and light and equity and rumours of the kingdom of heaven. And hopefully we do it through example as opposed to dogmatism. Really.
Stuart, thank you very much. We're going to give you a bit of a breather. I think we'll have the house lights on and then we'll have some questions.
That'd be great.
Can we thank Stuart? Questions. That's been great. Thank you very much. I'm keeping an eye on the time. We probably ought to take just a few questions, I see. We've got Hannah with a microphone. If you either jotted a question down during the interval or something's come to mind as Stuart's been sharing, if you pop your hand in the air, Hannah will come and bring you a microphone and we can hear your question. Anything anybody would like to ask, don't be shy. If anybody's got a question, either written down or just something that's come to mind, any questions for Stuart? I'm being very shy.
I think I flatten them all.
Go on. We got a question. We got one over here. Hannah, got one over here. Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah.
Stuart, if Jesus had been a poet, what sort of poetry would he have written?
Well, he was, really. And that's not a facetious answer, because he knew the scriptures. And somebody did a sort of analysis of the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, and bearing in mind the Bible that Jesus read was the Old Testament. That was the Bible, well, the first five books, and the wisdom literature. Those were his Bible. predominantly, especially within the wisdom books, there are strong elements and strands of poetry. So, but the mathematical study that was made came to the conclusion that 50% of the Bible is story, 30% is poetry, and only 20% is sort of hermeneutic and teaching. And that comes through Paul's letters, as he basically built the church on the run, really. So that's where the 20% teaching comes from. Going back to your question, there's a wonderful hidden bit in... just as prior to Jesus going into the Garden of Gethsemane, the disciples gathered for Pesach, for Passover. And at the end of that meal, because the Passover meal is actually quite rigorous in its application and evocation of Old Testament scriptures. And when it says they sang a hymn and they left. Well, what they were singing, in effect, was Psalms 113 to 118. They were singing it. They were singing the Psalms. They were singing poetry. And that's something that we've missed, really. Only because of, perhaps, and I count myself amongst that, that number, our ignorance of Jesus's Jewishness. the gospel is for Jew and Gentile alike, but it, our roots are within the Old Testament and Jesus' realization that he was the fulfillment of the law. So I wouldn't like to speculate as to what kind of poems he would have written, but he knew Jewish poetry by heart. Yeah. It was part of his DNA.
Yeah. Really? Thank you, Stuart. Any other questions? We've got lady at the back over there. Hannah? Sorry, we're going to have to ask you to run over there. Thank you, Hannah. Just don't say late. There we go. It's Roseanne at the back. Lovely.
The interval, and I've been writing poetry for some years, and I've got together. Ian Macmillan advised me to get it into collections.
All right,
five collections, and I'm trying to get them published. But what I wanted to ask you about was, I'm in touch online with Kenneth Stephen, and he's
yes.
a published poet.
Yeah.
And we had a bit of a not an argument, but he said, you'll never get your poetry published if it rhymes, if there's any rhyming in it. He said, you just won't get it published. And I said, well, I kind of disagreed with him, because I think there's times for rhyming and there's times for more prosaic sort of writing, and it depends how it sounds in your head. And I wondered what you think about that, about Kenneth Stephen's viewpoint that modern poets don't use rhyming.
I've met Kenneth a couple of times. I would say that's a very hard and fast and inflexible rule. I would point him towards Wendy Cope's new collection, who is probably one of the finest light verse, and I mean that as a great compliment. It's very difficult to write light verse. Light verse rhymer. Rhyme is wonder. I don't agree with Kenneth's advice that if it rhymes, you don't get published. Well, Roger McGough, Ian Macmillan, Wendy Cope. I could go on and on. Really, Helen Mort, very fine poet from this neck of the woods. Maybe Kenneth's not very good at rhyme. I don't know. I'm quite suspicious of because poetry attracts the emphatics, really. Poetry needs to be both and. Yeah. It can be rhyme or it can be blank verse. Yes. Yes. To that I would add that rhyme is about precision speech. Rhyme, if you're doing it properly, you have to be very precise. Mm. I was talking today at Wimble High, because even though the kids were, 7 or 8, I believe in sort of teaching them young. And so I was giving them examples of Dylan Thomas and Noel Coward, who's a very fine writer, very fine rhymer. And then I would point Kenneth towards the great songwriters such as Cole Porter and Lorenz Hart, who were brilliant street corner poets, although Cole Porter actually came from a very privileged background. But they made poetry accessible through musical theatre. A rhyme can say something very simple, very simply and very in a very profound way. All things pass, apart from communion and the Mass. And there you have something simple and hopefully profound. So that poets are renowned for basically starting fights in an empty room, along with the purpose of vision, can come perhaps with an aspect of woundedness as well.
Yeah.
So I would say, if it rhymes and if it's working, stick to it. It can be forced. The perfect example is the great McGonagall, Scotland's worst poet, on the death of Queen Victoria, for example. Dust to dust, ashes to ashes, into her tomb our great queen dashes. Not very good. So rhyme can go horribly wrong, and it can be brilliantly right.
Stuart, I think we probably ought to draw stumps fairly soon.
Yes,
coming
indeed.
Back to Harold Pinter in cricket.
Yes, and I'll you are. Oh, brilliant, brilliant.
Just one final thing to ask. You've obviously talked a bit about meeting people like Harold Pinter who didn't share your faith. What would you say to somebody who's saying, Stuart, I kind of respect your faith, but for me it's never something that's quite, I don't think I have that gift. What would you say to somebody like that?
I would say, very simply, this is not the end of the story. Yeah. You could be in for a surprise.
Great. Lovely. Stuart, thank you very much. Shall we? Friends, we're going to finish in just two